President Bill Clinton.
Thank you and good morning. Thank you, Kathy, for the introduction. And thank you and Paul Ramos for inviting me. I am really glad to be here for a number of reasons. First, I appreciate what you do. Secondly, as I was telling your leaders backstage, when Hillary and I were working on healthcare 20 years ago, the pharmacists were the single most helpful group in helping us to try to write the law in a way that made sense with what had to be done for the welfare of the American people and the integrity of the healthcare system. And third, I live in New York, and it's December, and we're in Las Vegas. And that's good for my health, too. I was laughing yesterday. I played golf in Washington with President Obama, and it was cold, dark, windy. He shows up, you know, thin clothes. I show up in my thermal underwear. And I said, you know, when I was a kid growing up, I could never figure out why people retired to Florida. Why would anybody leave wherever they were living, with their friends and their roots, and memories of their children, and go someplace just because it was warm all the time? I get it now. I want to talk a little today. I know we're going to have a question and answer session later, but I would like to try to talk about healthcare and talk about healthcare in America in the context of what I do with my foundation. You got a little flavor of it in the film. This is a profoundly important issue for any number of reasons. It is obviously, for America, critical to the health and well-being of our people. It's also critical to the health and well-being of our economy. In the last 2 years, we've had about 4% inflation in healthcare costs for the first time in 51 years. And that's really important because we spend almost 18% of our income on healthcare, and no other large wealthy country spends more than 11.8. That's about $1 trillion a year, the 6% difference in GDP. About 4 years ago, McKinsey and Company did an analysis of where the difference was, and there hasn't been anything that comprehensive since, but more or less it's like this. About 20% of it is due to administrative costs borne by providers, insurers, and employers because of the way we finance healthcare. It leads to massive increases in paperwork costs, which doubtless a lot of you deal with. It's about $200 billion a year, no small change now. And about more than 20% of it is rooted in our lifestyle choices. We spend more than $150 billion a year now just dealing with type 2 diabetes and its attendant consequences, which the American Medical Association said 3 years ago could no longer be referred to as adult onset diabetes. I knew that because we had just had a 9-year-old girl in New York City in Harlem diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. And about the same time, there was a 9-year-old boy in Washington, D.C. diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. That was another thing a lot of you have seen. About 40% of the difference is due to the way we deliver, manage, and price healthcare. and about 15% is everything else, including the fact that we spend more on the last 6 months of life than other people. But that's always struck me as kind of creepy, because a lot of times you don't know it's the last 6 months. And I think the only answer to that, in a country that believes we have a moral obligation to live as long and as well as we can, is to convince everybody to have a living will. And that would make a significant difference if a huge percentage of us did it. After my father-in-law had a terrible stroke, which left him with very little brain function, but he was a very tough old bird, and he hung on for 40 days. He hung on for 10 days after all the major life supports were removed. The first thing Hillary and I did was come home and make out living wills. So I think that will make a difference. There's one thing I want to say that's particularly troubling to me, but it shows that there is an overlap between our economic and social conditions and the health and welfare of the American people. About 10 days before the election, last November, I guess it was late October, on the front page of the New York Times, there was a story which achieved almost no notoriety because it was written as a healthcare piece, although I thought it should have been written as an economic piece. It said that America's life expectancy is continuing to rise for all groups except one: non-Hispanic whites who don't have any education beyond high school or who dropped out of high school. For them, there has been a stunning 4-year drop in life expectancy in the last 22 years among women, and about 3.5 years among men. The article, again written as a healthcare article, said there were three major causes. One is, in this group only, a big increase in smoking, and more among women than men, which seemed to account for the differential. Second, a big increase in obesity and its attendant consequences, even though the obesity levels were still high among Hispanics and African Americans. And third, a larger than average increase in mortality from prescription drug overdoses or other misuses. But they could have said, these people are dying of a broken heart, because they're the people who were raised to believe that the American dream would be theirs if they worked hard and their children would have a chance to do better. And their dreams were dashed disproportionate to the population as a whole. I say that because in the work I do around the world today in healthcare and in economic development and in education and in a number of other areas, especially related to energy and climate change, I see the intersection of health, economics, and politics all the time. And I'm sure you do too. So what I'd like to do is to start with this, the overview of how I came to do this healthcare work. It grew out of the way I view the world we're living in. It's a good news, bad news story. We live in the most interdependent age in human history, where people and ideas and information and technology and culture cross national borders, where all the borders look more like nets than walls, where the most successful countries are increasing in diversity. I mean, look around this room. We'd had this meeting 30 years ago, this crowd would not be nearly as diverse as it is today. It's a more interesting world, and it's fascinating. And for those of us who can claim its benefits, there's never been a better time to be alive. But it has three huge challenges. You may think there are 36 or 300, but they're all more or less broken down into three categories. First of all, there is way too much inequality to maintain a sense of social cohesion. Inequality in income, access to employment, access to capital to start a new business, access to education past a certain point, and too often access to decent health care. In the United States, there's been a big increase since I left office, and there was before, in the number of people living in poverty, especially children, and people working full-time. Around the world, about half the world's people still live on $2 a day or less. Billion people go to bed hungry every night. Billion people have no access to clean water. 2.5 billion people have no access to sanitation. I spent a lot of my life working in Haiti. The real reason we've got a cholera epidemic there is the absence of sanitation and clean water. So I see these inequalities, and I see how they work their way into the lives of people in America and around the world. You want to have some inequality in a society if you believe, as I do, that a market economy is the most efficient way to generate wealth and employment and give people opportunities. But if there is too much inequality, it not only really crushes the people who are on the short end of the stick, it operates as a severe constraint on economic growth. It limits the number of consumers. And I'll bet you've seen that in your work as well. So the trick is, how do you have a market economy with enough inequality to reward people who are especially hardworking, or especially creative, or especially good managers, or the people that we feature in Vegas, the great entertainers, the great athletes, without having so much that you slowly choke off the goose that laid the golden egg? And it's a challenge everywhere in the world. The second big problem is that there is too much instability. Again, in any dynamic society, you want some instability. For example, if you want to reward a person who starts a little company with an SBA loan that becomes Intel, there has to be the prospect of failure. That's why we have bankruptcy laws, so people can begin again, if necessary. So some instability is built in our system, and it's a good thing. But as the financial crisis showed, which spread across the world in a split second, if there is too much instability, you might as well have total rigidity, because either way, things just shut down. Because people are scared to take a risk, scared to make an investment. Even now, as we begin to come out of this financial crisis, we have American banks with over $1.5 trillion in cash not committed to loans. Still wary of getting back in there. People wary of borrowing the money to start a new business. It's the overhang of what happened in the financial crisis when there was too much money loaned with too little capital to back it up. You see it in the vulnerability people feel to terrorism, to drugs, to destructive forces which can cross national borders. You see it in countries, thank goodness, more in other places than America, where immigration has created enclaves of people who come to a new country but still only live with their own people. So there are religious and cultural and racial and ethnic tensions because the borders look more like nets than walls are, right? But once people live in the same proximity with people who have different views, they tend to erect mental walls. I read a book a couple of years ago that I recommend to all of you. It's a fascinating book about a much less toxic but still problematical American version of that, which we're seeing played out in this political fight in Washington now. It's called The Big Sort, S-O-R-T, written by a Texas journalist named Bill Bishop. Bishop was a confessed liberal Democrat who lived in a neighborhood in Austin, Texas, where John Kerry defeated President Bush 3-1. He had one Republican neighbor He loved the guy. Their children played together. They took a walk every day. He said, he's the only guy I could have a discussion with where I had a disagreement, but I might actually learn something. He learned something from me. Unfortunately, my other neighbors weren't so nice to him, so he moved to another neighborhood in Austin where President Bush defeated John Kerry 4-1. And the conclusion of Bishop's book is, look, we are so past a lot of our past bigotries. We're not as sexist or as racist or as homophobic as we used to be. Now we just don't want to be around anybody who disagrees with us. We're laughing, but we're all a little that way, aren't we? Aren't we? And the point Bishop made was, when that guy moved out of my neighborhood into the other neighborhood, we all lost. And then he started doing research. And he looked at the voting patterns of counties, because unlike congressional districts, county lines, you know, they stay stable, they stay the same. So in 1976, when President Carter and President Ford had a razor-close presidential election, there were only 20% of the counties in America that voted for either one of them by 20 points or more. So in 80% of the counties, you could go in a barbershop, a beauty shop, a restaurant, a bowling alley, go to your local civic club meeting, and people were actually sitting around discussing the election with their friends and neighbors, trying to figure out what the right thing to do was. By 2004, we don't have any data, at least I don't, on the last two elections, but by 2004, when you had another razor-thin election and President Bush got the smallest re-election margin of any re-elected president since Woodrow Wilson in 1916, 48% of the counties in America voted for one or the other of them by more than 20 points. We are really sorting ourselves by our politics and by our view of the world. And so I would argue that contributes to instability, not stability. But anyway, you can see it. You can see it in our vulnerability to terror, to drugs, to financial crises. There is a high level of instability, and if we feel too threatened by it and we draw into a shell, it robs us of a lot of the potential of the 21st century world. And we're scared to get talking to somebody that disagrees with us. And we're scared we'll be shunned if we make an agreement with them. And that's a little bit of what's going on in Washington today. It's not good for anybody. The third problem the world has is that the way we produce and consume energy is causing climate change, and it is not sustainable. We can preserve a global market economy, we can create more opportunity for people, but we got to change the way we produce and consume energy. And nearly everybody in the world has accepted this, which is why there are so many changes. This is the only country in the world where any major political party actually still questions whether it's real or not. Everywhere else, the conservatives and the liberals are debating what to do about it. For example, Sweden had a conservative government, not a liberal government, in 1991 when they adopted the world's first carbon tax. And they had a perfectly conservative tax. It's the only tax in history anywhere where they gave they just taxed you, you paid the tax, then they gave it all back to you. It was an ingenious experiment. They said, we just want every person in this country to understand the damage they do to our future by the carbon they emit. And we trust them, not the government, we trust them to do what's best. So if you had a bill for $1,000, the government gave you $1,000 back. They said, now you know, you want to spend it like you did last year, have at it. But you ought to spend it on becoming more efficient so our country will be stronger over the long run. They then proceeded to have a few years where the economy grew by 50% and they reduced their greenhouse gas emissions while growing the economy. with no laws, no regulation, no nothing. They just sent everybody a bill for their carbon footprint every year, gave them the money back, and said, we trust you. And sure enough, they built one of the most energy efficient countries in the world. So there are all these things going on, but if you look at this Hurricane Sandy, that was still a terrible storm when it hit New York, is an example of what has been happening for 20 years now. In the decade when I was president, insured losses, that is, those insurance companies had to pay on, were three times greater worldwide than they had ever been before. Then in the 10 years after I left office, they were three times greater than the previous decade. You cannot say that global warming caused any of these storms. But what you can say is it makes them more severe. All you got to do is stick a thermometer in the ocean, because we know warmer water roils more. So what are the things that might have made it worse this year? Just for example, 8% of the world's fresh water is on top of Greenland. And if it all melts and flows into the North Atlantic, it could completely block the Gulf Stream, which is the warm water and its attendant air that flows north and keeps Northern Europe, Northern Canada, and the Northeast United States livable and functional in cold months. If that happened, particularly in the Northern European countries, some of the most productive countries on Earth, it could make them as cold as they were 700 years ago while the west of the planet's warming up. It would be calamitous. So the good news is, in a couple of years, you'll be able to take a boat every summer across the North Pole. The bad news is, in a couple of years, you'll be able to take a boat across the summer, North Pole in the summertime. This year, 90% of the ice cap on Greenland showed some melting. The 100-year average is 50%. It almost certainly slowed the Gulf Stream, which created an air wall on the East Coast. Usually, a hurricane like Sandy would have hit Haiti, which it did, and which had more lost lives than we did. And now those of us that are helping have to go down and try to pick up the pieces and resume the progress. But we all know that at this time of year, the wind blows hard from west to east, right? So I got up this morning at 5 o'clock, left my house at 6, dutifully flew out here. It took me 45 minutes longer than it normally would because we had a huge headwind. It just happened. Normally what happens is when these hurricanes come up, this wind blows them out to sea. And what happened with Sandy is it didn't blow it out to sea because there was a blocking wall there. So I spend a lot of my life trying to figure out how to make this good economics. How can we find ways to change the way we produce and consume energy in poor countries and wealthy countries that are good economics? For example, in America, the cheapest thing we can do is retrofit all of our buildings. That's a big portion of what we emit. In the rest of the world, the cheapest thing we could do is close every landfill in every big city in the world, stop cooking with charcoal and wood, and make sure these room air conditioners don't emit CFCs and HFCs, because those things together are about as big a problem as coal, and you can get them out of the air a lot quicker. But the point of all this is the following. This brings you back to healthcare. If you believe that we're living in a fine time of unprecedented opportunity, that if extended to too few, gets shut down too much by instability and can be cut short by the problems associated with climate change, then the clear mission of everybody in the 21st century world, whatever you're doing, is to build up the positive forces of our interdependence, to take advantage of the fact that the world looks more like borders that are nets than borders that are walls, and to reduce the negative forces. And that's how I think about trying to deal with the healthcare challenges. I want to make one more point that I think is really important. before we move to the questions, and I'd say a few specific things about America. Dealing with these kind of problems in a very poor place is very different than dealing with them in a well-developed country. Like, poor countries need systems that have predictable positive results for good conduct. I mean, just think about the systems that none of you have thought about yet today. You would be shocked if the screen failed and those of you in the back that, like me, need glasses couldn't see. If the temperature controls went on the blink and all this hot air I'm putting out made you uncomfortable. If the microphone failed or the lights went dark. And if you get bored with my speech, you can get up and go to the restroom. And while there, if you had a cup, you could drink a glass of water without giving it a second thought. I spend a lot of my life in places where not a single thing I just mentioned can be taken for granted by anybody. Those people need systems. So, for example, in Rwanda, where I work with Partners in Health to build a hospital in every region of the country, they still have a real problem. They've got a country with over 10 million people, only 630 doctors. So we got this unprecedented partnership going with 13 different American universities, medical schools, people that train nurses and other medical professionals. And we are going there to help train people for a model national healthcare system that the Rwandans can afford. They've got a hospital in every region now, including one, thanks to the American race car driver, Jeff Gordon, that provides the best cancer care anywhere in Central Africa. And then they're going to build satellite clinics that are just going to be a couple hours walk from the hospital. And then in the poor, remoter villages, they will train community health workers to go out there and identify basic problems so they know who to send to the clinics, and then they'll know who to send to the hospitals. And we have to train a lot of people to run the system. So they asked me to figure out what the most economical way to do it was. And these 13 American medical centers agreed to do this work for 2 years, unbelievably, for a total overhead of 7%. That is less than a fourth of what non-governmental organizations usually charge to work in other countries. And it's a real triumph. But we're trying to build a system because the Rwandans are determined to be free of all foreign aid by 2020. And that's what you want. You want to, when you work in a country, you want to work yourself out of a job so people can stand on their own two feet and do their own business. So anyway, that's typical of what we did. When I started working in Ethiopia, a country with more than 80 million people, 60% of them live in more than 60,000 villages with fewer than 100 people, fewer than 1,000 people. And in those 60,000 villages, there were a grand total of 700 clinics in 60,000 villages. So if you flew to Addis Ababa tonight, and God forbid you got food poisoning on the airplane, you'd be fine when you landed because they have a good healthcare system in the capital. If you met the Ethiopian health minister, and you spent 30 minutes with him, you would say, I'd feel comfortable if that man were the Secretary of Health and Human Services in the United States. He's that good, and so is the woman who runs the healthcare system in Rwanda. But it's like falling off a cliff when you left the town. So I said, what do you want us to do? They said, build us 3,500 clinics, and then everybody will be at least within a day's walk of healthcare. I said, how many to get to 3 hours walk? They said, 16,000. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. But you see what I mean? It's a system building thing. Now, in a place like the United States, or Europe, or any other advanced society, we've got systems. That's how we all got here today. That's what got you into these chairs. But since time immemorial, you can go back 8,000 years to the Sumerian civilization. It's the same thing. This is just human nature. Once you build systems, they reach a point when they become too rigid. They're not as change-oriented because there are too many people benefiting from the way things are. So people are more interested in holding on to where they are and advancing the purpose for which the systems were established in new circumstances. So the trick in this whole healthcare deal is how to advance the purpose for which all of you got into this. How can we provide affordable quality healthcare to all Americans at a price which leaves enough money left in the economy to continue to grow it and invest in education and enable people to raise their kids? A huge headline in USA Today about 2 months ago saying that the principal reason that millions of Americans worked the entire last decade without a pay raise is that their employers are spending all their excess revenue paying for health insurance premiums and they didn't have enough left to give them a pay raise. So we have the need for system reform. And I just have a couple of observations on that, if I might. One is, it's really important that this group do whatever you can to make sure that we implement this Affordable Care Act properly. And if there are things that are wrong with it, both with the way the law's written or the way the regulations come out, that you move as quickly and aggressively as you can, because you are trusted, I believe, by both parties in Washington as people who are really interested in making the system work, that you be active in that. It's one thing to pass a law and another thing altogether to change lives in a way that is positive. There's often a big gap. You know that old saying, as many as slip between the cup and the lip. And it is inconceivable that Albert Einstein alone in a room could not have dealt with a matter of this complexity without forgetting to do something or doing something that would have an unintended consequence. So I think that's really important. The second thing I think is important is that we need your help to make sure that these magnificent advances in pharmaceuticals actually work to make people healthier and are coupled with changes in lifestyle. My major healthcare initiative is something called the Alliance for a Healthier Generation, and I started with the Heart Association after I had my heart surgery. And they wanted me to help them, and I said, look, I'll do it, but I'm not interested in doing PSAs or just raising money. I want to deal with this problem. This is a horrible problem. So, make a long story short, after about 6 years now, we've got programs in 15,000 schools changing the health habits of both the students as well as the faculty and staff, trying to increase exercise. We've cut deals with major providers of food because as the schools have become more cash-strapped, more and more of them have contracted out their meals. And what they were contracted out was terrible. And before the new standards the federal government has imposed us this year on food, we had voluntary agreements with companies feeding 30 million children in school to reduce the caloric content and increase the nutritional value of the meal. And most important, about 5 years ago, we made an agreement with the big soft drink providers, which now encompass more than 95% of the schools in America. And just last year, an independent review, having nothing to do with us, said that there has been a 90% reduction in the total calories served for children in schools through drinks, both soft drinks and juice. And it was all voluntary. We just basically got them together like we did when we cut the crisis of AIDS drug and said, look, we know you're not trying to kill these kids. We know you don't want them to have diabetes and be amputees when they're in their 30s. We know you want them to keep drinking soft drinks for their lifetime. What we're doing is not working. And if you all change together, you can make money in a different way. Same thing we did with the providers of age growth. I never asked anybody to lose money. I just asked them to make money in a different way that's good for the public health. And so they got rid of all the full sugar drinks. They went to smaller servings of juice that has a lot of sugar in it. They went to more flavored waters. They did a lot of very clever things. They're all still making money, and there's been a 90% reduction in the caloric content. We need your support and involvement to do that. It's amazing how many people listen to their pharmacists who don't have a relationship, some of them even with the doctors. They listen to you. We gotta stay at this. We can't blame the medical system for costs and burdens that we impose on it through decisions we make. And for that support. And my latest healthcare venture, which I have no idea whether we can succeed at, but we had so much good fortune with this other effort, I decided to try it. It's called Health Matters, and we're trying to basically get the non-youth population involved in the same kind of behavior changes and get the people that are feeding in bad elements to change what they're doing. And we started last year, but I'm going to particularly focus on the baby boomers because I'm the oldest of the baby boomers. I hate it, but it's true. And if we consume healthcare dollars on a per capita basis at the same rate as a generation older than us, we're going to bankrupt the system no matter what else everybody else does. We simply have to stay healthier. So if we take more medication, it's got to be medication, first of all, that's properly reconciled, that works, and it keeps us out of the hospital. It keeps us out of surgery. It keeps us out of being a burden to our children and their ability to raise our grandchildren. It is profoundly important. And so we're going to have in January, associated with Humana and some others that have helped us with the old Bob Hope Golf Tournament in Southern California, we're going to have this big conference and kick off what we're doing, and I hope we can really have a difference, make a difference there. And I've tried to respond also to this report that I mentioned at the outset of my talk about where life expectancy is declining, and particularly on this prescription drug business. I don't know if any of you saw it, but last night Sanjay Gupta on CNN reran a special he did on prescription drug problem that I participated in almost exactly a year ago. In the space of 10 days, my across the street neighbor, who's a Kosovar Albanian immigrant, whose relatives are in the government in Kosovo, and therefore I'm close to them because we saved their country in 1999, had five children, four girls and a boy, and his youngest son, 30, died within 10 days of one of my closest friends, 28-year-old son, who was working for my wife, death. Neither one of them intended to kill themselves. They both went out with their girlfriends, drank a few beers, and thought they'd get a buzz by popping an OxyContin, and they never woke up. One was not particularly well educated. The other was in a program at George Washington University to get a law degree and an MBA. And I had known him since he was a boy, and I am 100% certain that neither one of those young men thought he was committing suicide. I am 100% certain that they did not know the basic biochemistry that the two things when mixed could deaden the part of the brain that keeps your body breathing when you're asleep. You know all this, and you probably have your own stories. But this is the sort of thing that we can change. You can change a culture. Yes, there are some people who have knowingly abused these prescriptions and violated the law doing it, and Our biggest problems are probably in California and Florida, and there's been an attempt in New York, and there's been an attempt to crack down on it. But you can help with this. We simply cannot afford to continue to do things which cause human loss with medications that are supposed to alleviate human suffering. And these are all things we have to own. We can't blame the politicians, can't blame the health insurance companies, can't blame anybody for stuff that is in our control if we don't do everything we can. We do everything we can and we're still being frustrated, then we can look for somebody else to blame. But I have found it more productive to look for something positive to do. So that's what I wanted to say to you. The job in a rich country is to reform our systems. We're now trying to reform our federal budget system, our health care system, our national defense for the 21st century. We're reforming our financial rules so we don't have another financial crash. We're in the reform business. And the better we do it, the stronger America will be in the future. On the health care front, we need your help. And you have proved to me over two decades that you really do care about the purpose for which you went into this work. We need that kind of purpose-driven reform today. Thank you very much.
Sharing your unique perspectives and insights and observations with us. And now we have time for just a few questions. So, let's